Welcome to Intersection Live, the tax and accounting profession's premier podcast source. Provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting. The Intersection Live podcast series is brought to you by ADP Small Business Services, supporting the accountant community. This is Tech to Go, a monthly fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnists Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession.
This is Tech to Go, episode 23, User Conference Review 2008. Hello, Greg LaFollette, Tech to Go, episode 23, a part of Intersection Live, the podcast series of the CPA Technology Advisor. Today I have regular panelists from all over the U.S., our friend Randy Johnston, today calling in from the islands out in Hawaii. Thank you so much, Randy, for taking your early morning coffee on the lanai and visiting with us.
Aloha from Kauai. It's gorgeous here.
Good for you. Warmer than it is here in South Dakota, I'm sure.
Yeah, guaranteed.
Also with us is Brent Goodfellow, our regular panelist from the Pacific Northwest. Good morning, Brent.
Good morning. 43 and foggy here.
Hey, you know, it's always foggy there. If it's not raining, it's gonna rain. That's the forecast under Mount Hood, right?
That's right.
Okay, well, welcome and thanks again for sharing some time with us. And quasi regular panelist Darren Root, contributing editor to the CPA Technology Advisor and practitioner in Bloomington, Illinois, is joining us again. Darren, this is second, third, fourth time you've been with us on Tech2Go?
Yeah, a few times, but I actually am in Indiana. You made that mistake once of going to Illinois, I believe.
What did I say? Now I said Bloomington, Illinois this time, right?
Yeah.
I actually did that, but we don't want to talk about how terrible that was to have to admit that I'd flown to the wrong city. That was just a bad deal. Well, today we're recording episode 23 of Tech to Go, and just as a kind of a catch up for everybody, I want to kind of start with some of the user conferences. I've seen all of you guys once or twice over the last two or three weeks. All of the three major suppliers to the accounting profession, at least on the in-firm side, that would be CCH, Thomson Reuters, and Intuit, all have had user conferences over the last couple of weeks. And the Intuit one is actually the Sleater group conference, which is not an official Intuit one, but I guess other than maybe the enterprise gathering, probably the largest gathering of in this case, QuickBooks advisors and things in the country. And so I want to kind of review just a little bit with the panelists what some of their observations were on the different user conferences. And I think I'm going to start with Brent Goodfellow. Brent, I had opportunity to sit down and enjoy actually a nice meal and some really great entertainment with you one night at the at that conference out in Palm Desert for CCH. Give us kind of a rundown and, you know, give me kind of your ideas. We'll tell the other guys a little bit about that.
Well, it was a beautiful setting. You know, Palm Springs is beautiful, and to go there in the fall, it was nice and warm. And I found that there was so much that interested me inside that I had a hard time getting outside. And we were at a beautiful property there at the Marriott. I thought CCH did a tremendous job considering. I think this was their fourth user conference, something
right,
like that. I thought that the general sessions were very well done, and I was impressed that there wasn't a significant press on selling their products, which you know some of the user conferences there's this press on sales of products, and it was truly a soft sell. At least that was my impression of the way CCH handled it. And I thought the speakers that were there were excellent, and that the topics were very, very timely.
The young man from Australia, Peter Sheehan.
Sheehan, right.
Peter Sheehan, 29-year-old young man from, I was going to call him a kid. I guess I can call him, he's still not 30, he's still a kid, right?
Yep.
Probably one, if not the best keynote speaker I've ever heard, certainly among the top four or five. This young man is absolutely outstanding. What a dynamite speaker, talking about Gen X issues and really understands the practice of public accounting too, which oftentimes speakers come in and they look at the profession and say, yeah, it's the same as all the rest of the businesses, and you know we are in some cases, but in a lot of cases we're very different.
Yeah. Yeah, he really related to the younger set, and I think he related to the older set as well because, you know, he was able to bridge the gap having had that experience in public accounting.
There, you pointed out that was their fourth user conference. I mean, beautiful spot, no doubt. Their numbers have gone about 300 at the first one, about 600 at the second one, about 900 at the third one, and 1,200 at this one.
Yeah.
You know, they're obviously doing something right.
They are, and they, you know, they treat their attendees just extremely well in terms of the quality of the location and the food and the meeting rooms and the entertainment. It was just really top drawer, in my opinion.
Now, I would point out that in terms of pricing, it is by far the most expensive for the attendees. But you know, when we're talking about the most expensive, you're really only talking about maybe a few hundred dollars more than the other ones. So you're somewhere. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I think it was somewhere around $2,000 a head. But as opposed to, you know, some of the other ones we're going to talk about are more in the $1,000 or $1,200 range, and then I think the Sleater conference is more like in the $600 or $700 range. So there's a big difference. But I suppose once you get on an airplane and fly across the country and spend a couple 3 nights or 4 nights in a hotel and stuff, the difference of between $500 and $1,500. I don't want to be flip about $1,000, but it's not as material as it sounds. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it's kind of a different demographic too. You know, the CCH conference tends to cater to larger, firms as opposed to Thomson Reuters, and I think the Sleater conference generally caters to the smaller bookkeeping type firms for the most part.
Yeah, I think that's quite accurate. So, what of you sat in on a bunch of classes there, Brent? Anything strike you as particularly helpful? I mean, it looked to me like they did a lot of things. In all of these, there's a lot of product training, but there's also a whole bunch of other things. Anything you saw there that you were particularly interested in?
Well, I pretty much avoided the product training, although I did sit in on a couple of Adobe classes because I was just curious as to what kinds of things they were teaching there, and it was very specific in terms of what they were covering. I sat in on a linking compensation to performance class. That was a little more squishy in terms of its topic. It was a consultant that was a coach for firms in trying to craft these agreements where they link compensation to performance. And I did sit in on a virtualization presentation that was done by one of the tech people at CCH. And I thought he did a good job explaining how virtualization applies to public accounting.
One of the keynotes that really, really impressed me was CCH President Mike Sabatis. I've known Mike for a long, long time, and his keynote I thought was absolutely astounding. And I went to him afterwards and I said, Mike, I don't know how to tell you this. I'm not trying to insult you, but I've never considered you a great speaker. I mean, you're a nice guy, but I never watched you and said, wow, this guy is a great speaker. And when I got done with that, I said, wow, this guy is a great speaker. He's a great presenter, very, very motivated. And I wasn't quite sure. I was at a CCH users conference when I heard Mike talking about World of Warcraft and the social networking kinds of things, and you know I wrote a couple of articles on the tech gap specifically around how impressive it was to see a company that's traditionally been they have black books with gold paint, gold print on them, they're pretty staid. And these guys are moving ahead really, really quickly. I was very impressed.
Yeah, he came across as a very personable speaker, I thought, and really related well to the group that was there.
What was the demographics of? I mean, is it a younger crowd, kind of middle age, or what are you seeing at the CCH conference?
Well, I thought it mirrored the demographics of the profession pretty well. I thought the 50 plus. Demographic probably had the larger share in terms of numbers. That was my impression anyway.
I think that's true, Brent. I've noticed over the last 10 years that attendees have been getting younger, but I think I know why that is. Darren, now I saw you the following week. In fact, I was home for 36 hours in between those two conferences, and then back down to Dallas to the Gaylord, another beautiful facility, where Thompson was holding what they termed their 28th user conference. That's the successor to the old CSI user conference, and then it was the Thompson CS, and now the Thomson Reuters CS User Conference. You've been at that. Well, I've been at that with you for years and years and years. What were your observations down there?
Well, the Gaylord Texan Hotel was beautiful as well, and it was a beautiful time in Dallas. I mean, it was 75 each day. When you live in southern Indiana, you take 75 whenever you can get it.
It's 75 inside the Gaylord all the time, Darren. It doesn't matter.
Well, maybe that was what it was, because I didn't get outside.
Nor did I.
There was just a lot going on. I think there was about 750 attendees there, which is up a little bit from the prior year. Classes were good. They unveiled this new Service Bureau payroll product there. John Barron did in his keynote. Didn't spend a lot of time talking about it, but he talked about it being available now. I thought the conference was good. I taught four classes, so I didn't attend a lot of other classes. I find one of the best values is just kind of the networking, getting to know the other attendees. From what I heard, about 50% of the attendees there were, this was their first time being at a Thompson Users Conference, which, is that fairly standard, Greg, or is it normally have about 50% new?
I'm going to say that's around average, and I think that's fairly healthy. Randy, you've gone to bazillions of these. What do you think?
Yeah, I was going to say it's about average, I would say. So not out of the ordinary one way or the other.
Yeah. One of the interesting things when you get over to the Thompson side, the conference there, one of the things that fascinates me is these roundtables that they do. I mean, CCH does roundtables, but they're kind of late in the afternoon. the roundtables that Thompson does are in the evening from 8 till 10. They couldn't kick people out of this room. I mean, I left it at 10:45, and the room was still full. People still sitting there, and they're talking. They're talking work talk, you know. There were probably, I'm going to say, there were 400 people in a room. I did a round table on social networking, and there were probably, I'm going to say, there were 30 plus people around the table, trying to talk about how that was working and what people were doing and what was going to happen and stuff. These people are really, really, really motivated and really into the whole idea of learning. And I mean, I at 10 o'clock we were supposed to end. At about 10:20, I said to the people at my table, you know, do you guys know there are bars in this hotel, right? You know, we don't have to stay here. And they're really into it. You were there, I assume, that night, Darren.
I was. I did a couple round tables as well that night, and kind of like you, I mean, we had to pull two tables together, and they were two deep all the way around.
Right.
And people just had so many questions. I think that the learning, the people are so engaged at these user conferences, or at least the ones I go to,
right,
so intent on learning. It makes for a lot of fun.
One of the things I thought John Barron did the best job I have ever heard him do at a user conference, and I told him that, and he said, well, that was because I didn't have a chance to prepare as much as I usually do. And I said, well, he was very human. He did a really, really good job. He was very personable, very human. Didn't try to cram 140 slides into an hour and a half presentation. Usually his presentations are very, very dense in terms of content, and this tended to be lighter and more visionary, less tactical and more strategic. And I think the audience really appreciated that, seeing what the vision was. And one of the things that he said, there were actually two things that impressed me a lot, but one was as he explained the redesign and the future of the current write-up product and the current bookkeeping product, and Randy and Brent, you'll find this interesting if you didn't know about it. Their plan on this and what they're doing is to build a web-enabled, land-based, but web-enabled, and the ability to run either locally or on the land to make the information, what I call exchangey, so it's automatically synchronized, and to allow a client to use what they have, that CBS product for client accounting, client bookkeeping, to allow the client to look at the same data set that the accountant is looking at, and let the accountant control the ways in which the accountant, what he can see and how he can interact. And you look at that and say, wow, that's a wonderful, wonderful idea. You ever heard of that, Randy?
I have not heard it from that company, but do know of multiple companies trying to do that strategy.
Yeah, well, this is Chandra Bhansali's product in Accountants Relief, right?
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he is doing it that way right now. But this
right.
whole idea of synchronization and having the files looked at the same time and changed, and take it a little bit further, allowing you to work offline and disconnected and then resynchronizing, that kind of is leading towards the Windows Live Mesh approach to all this.
Right.
And the virtual desktop. So, you know, we continue to see those technologies converge. So that's actually superb news from a Thompson perspective.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. The other thing that that John announced, and he went past it really, really fast, I think there were people in the audience who had just seen it and began to kind of Twitter, and I don't mean tweet, but a little flutter of conversation in the audience, and then he went on to something else. Otherwise, I think the audience would have applauded for this. He showed a function of UltraTax that allows a preparer to select a form within UltraTax, any form that you might happen to want to select, and let's say, for example, it's Schedule C, and the tabs across the top, once you're looking at Schedule C in the window, the tabs across the top show Schedule C in the center, and to the left of it, you see the forms that are contributors to Schedule C, and the tabs across on the right side are dependents of Schedule C. So, for example, the depreciation schedule or auto deduction or whatever it might be that is a contributor to Schedule C would be on the left, and the SE and the Schedule A and other things would be on the right. So you could actually help trace exactly how tax returns are put together for people who've, those of us who've ever done those things with pen and paper and pencil, we're about all to die.
You know, it was really, I spent some time looking at that feature, Greg, and it's really going to be a neat new feature because, you know, you're always looking as to where did this number come from, and now it's going to be just a click away, so that'll be really nice.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. So we spent a couple 3 days in Dallas, and you know we were talking before about the great job that that CCH had done out in Palm Desert, and when you get over to Dallas, I mean also a very nice job, but heavy hors d'oeuvres every night and dinner in Palm Desert, and you get over to Dallas, prices is significantly less. Prices, $400-$600 less, whatever it happened to be. I mean, it's certainly less per attendee, but instead of an open bar, I think they got a couple of drink tickets, and instead of heavy hors d'oeuvres, they had peanuts and pretzels, and just a difference in the level of physical accoutrements. Does that make sense, Darren? Am I saying that about right?
Yeah, and I think that's fair. But I do think, Brent mentioned earlier that the attendee is a little different there. You know, it's a little bit more of a smaller firm. I don't know what that demographic is, but,
right.
Five-person to 25-person is probably the norm there. I'm guessing CCH is a little larger than that, Brent.
Yeah, I think so. I think the demographic on the average CCH user is probably 20 plus. I know there are some firms that are smaller than that use CCH software, but generally it's above 20, I would guess.
Yeah, and there are certainly outliers on both of those sides, but I think what you guys are saying is accurate.
I thought the event was nice, but like you say, Greg, it was probably scaled down a bit from what I heard you and Brent
right.
talking about the CCH
right.
event being.
So then just for real contrast now, pop out of Dallas, come home for a couple of days, jump on another airplane, head out to Phoenix, where I flew out on Monday. The Sleater Group accounting software consultants conference started formally on Tuesday. I flew out on Monday, and I walked in walked down the hall to see who's down there, and I see that there is a pre-conference session going, and taught by none other than Randy Johnson, talking about remote access. And so I go, well, I'll just wander in here and see if Randy's got some people in here for a pre-conference. I walked in, and there were, 125 people in there, Randy?
Yeah, actually, even a few more than that, Greg. And as it turns out, the Taking Your Practice Online session, which I had worked through and designed with Doug Sleater's guidance, turned out to be a superb hit, we thought, and
right.
Amazing number of people who paid extra money to attend that pre-conference session. And it really revolved around the concepts of software as a service and or hosting to bridge to get us there, and then how we basically manage this whole operation of this new generation of applications, or use the old generation of applications while we're waiting for new ones to arrive.
You know, as I sat in your class for a couple of hours, and I was struck by a couple of things. Number one, I was struck at the number of people who were actually very advanced, doing lots of very, very interesting things. And about the time that I'd sit there and go, wow, this group is really, really moving ahead, then someone would stand up and say, what's a VPN? Or what do you mean I can control my office machine from somewhere else? And, you know, so, I mean, you had people all through the entire spectrum there.
Yeah, it is one of the challenges when you've got, groups that you try not to leave people behind who are behind the curve, and by the same token that you challenge people who are leading the edge. And, in fact, we did have a broad range of skills, and it was not a surprise to me to have that happen simply because I've had that happen not only at the Sleeper Conference but at others in the past.
Right.
Really, there were some brilliant things being done that I hadn't considered, which is always a great pleasure to learn something new while you're presenting. And in the big picture of things, I think we really helped frame in a lot of those attendees' minds how they could take their practice, do everything without internal servers, and that it could actually be a much better experience for both them and their clients.
So in terms of numbers, Randy, give us a little flavor of how this thing looked. You heard us talking about the CCH and the Thompson Conference. Tell us a little bit about what you saw there. We were at the a beautiful John Q. Hammonds Hotel in Glendale, right next to the stadium out there. It was a beautiful facility.
Yeah, in fact, the Renaissance was really an excellent place to hold this, and I was amazed since the Monday night football game was right there while we were there.
Right.
But, in terms of the attendees, Doug had a good number of attendees, a fairly large number of exhibitors as well. I think his conference held its own or might have been down just a little bit this year in terms of its attendance. But there was actually a greater number of vendors than the prior year. And all around, the attendees who were there and the vendors that I talked to that had done displays were pleased with the experience and the exposure.
You know, there were I think, some 50 vendors there, 51, and I talked to a lot of them, and many of them told me it was the best conference trade show experience that they had in all 2008, and certainly not the largest. I mean, there were, I suppose there were 400 or 500 people there. But the, what they all tell me is that these people who are QuickBooks consultants, many, and not just QuickBooks, Nina Smith, a VP over at Sage was one of the keynoters. So, I mean, Sage is there, Microsoft is there, and, they're talking about small business accounting, but obviously, QuickBooks is the 900-pound gorilla. But all of those people, those attendees are really, I mean, they're over spending time at every single booth, making sure that they really, really understand what the different people are offering in terms of solutions, because they want to go home and have more tools in their toolkit.
That's correct. These people really dissect the products that they support and potential solutions for their clients more thoroughly than just about any group that I'm aware of out there. And because of that, obviously, the vendors get this very direct interaction and, I think, a fair bit of follow-up business that comes out of the event. So that's really productive for the clients, for the attendees, for the vendors. All three really win on that front. And, when you get the opportunity to talk directly to the business decision makers of companies like Mysis or SmartWall, where the CEO and founders are there, Rene Lassert from Bill.com, we could go down through the litany.
Right.
I was really amazed that it was not, trade show type of people. It really was the top, one, two, in some cases even three people of the company. And you're right. Sage had a large contingent there. Intuit had a very large contingent there. And when we look at the amount of resources that these different organizations were throwing at the situation, obviously they think it's justified, and I agree with them.
Right. On Thursday morning, Doug started a bit of his wrap-up with a kind of a town hall type meeting where he basically went through each one of the sessions that were offered and took feedback from the audience, which I thought was pretty gutsy to do in a room with hundreds of people. I mean, we're talking 300 or 400 attendees in an open room taking feedback. And what I heard over and over and over, and this is, I'm going to do the keynote immediately following Doug's presentation, and what I hear over and over and over, these people standing up and saying, well, I went to Randy Johnson's class on this and it was the best class ever. And then somebody else would get up and say, no, I went to Randy Johnson's class on this and that was the best class. And so Randy, you certainly won hands down the returning presenter award, and all of these people talking about how great your classes were. And then the other part that I thought was particularly interesting was when Doug said, okay, now we had a bunch of new presenters, people that we brought in just this year for the very first time. Tell me what you thought of them. And all I heard was Darren Root this and Darren Root that. So Darren, you certainly hit a home run there too. You did a couple of classes. What were you doing?
I did taking payroll online, and then I did one called Next Generation Accounting Firm, where we talk about a lot of different things. And yeah, they were both well attended, and I thought the classes went pretty well.
Well, all in all, I thought that was a great conference. My laptop failed about the last. I was about 10 minutes from finishing my keynote, and all of a sudden my laptop went into hibernate mode. Evidently, when we plugged it in, somebody had turned off the power strip after we got going, and of course I didn't notice the little teeny icon was down there, was on battery power, and it was on all of the time that Doug was speaking, and all of a sudden just died. So that certainly made life exciting, you know, for a minute, but we survived. So anyway, it was interesting to see all of you at all of those different conferences. And one of the things that happened in that town hall meeting were a bunch of questions around Vista. And Randy, you answered many of those questions. That crowd surprised me. There were a large number of people who raised their hands saying, you know, not only do I not use Vista, but I'll never use Vista, and I hate Vista, and I thought we were going to do a Mojave ad there for a few minutes, and you were kind of smiling at him, telling him, you know what, get over it. But talk to me a little bit. You and Brent are both real deep into this. A lot of practitioners out there right now with XP. Thinking about Vista, now we've got Windows 7 looking like it's going to be released sometime about a year from now or a little less maybe. What's a smart practitioner to do? Brent, what are you telling your people?
Well, Windows 7 is going to be like XP was to Windows 2000. You know, it's going to be kind of like an R2 version. So it's still going to be based on the look and feel of Vista. And the fact that you can't buy XP anymore, I'm kind of in Randy's corner. I think it's time to leave XP behind and move ahead. You know, life goes on, and we have to learn to change, and that's the advice I'm giving folks.
Randy, agree or disagree?
Yeah, no, it's really, at this point, we don't know of any notable applications that aren't compatible. We find experiences running on Vista are generally more solid. We find that people are buying new equipment and trying to downgrade it to XP and having trouble because drivers are not available and the hardware is not compatible with XP. It was designed for Vista, and there will probably never be XP drivers made for that new generation hardware. I just can't give a good business reason not to move on with Vista at this point. The end user interfaces with the operating system really so little that the small bit of learning curve to run on Vista versus running on XP, with the benefits that are there, like the desktop search facility and others, now I just can't really, in good conscience, move on. Now, the one recommendation that I make publicly that, you know, I can be swayed on a little bit is I've really been a promoter of 64-bit Vista because of the ability to use extra RAM, and specifically I'm after 4 gig of RAM or more, and since most of the prior versions of XP or Vista 32 really kind of max out at 3 gig, if you're going to put 4 gig or more in these machines, you have to be on Vista 64 to take advantage of that. And there are a few oddities, and there are still organizations claiming they don't support Vista 64. But honestly, I've had almost no experience or any problems, is probably the better way to say it, that are bad running applications on Vista 64. In fact, it's the other way around. I'm finding that applications that actually ran not so well on Vista 32 actually wind up running a little better on Vista 64.
And,
yeah,
go ahead, Brent.
I was just going to say I've been running on Vista 64 as well, and for the most part, my experience mirrors Randy's, although I have run into an application or two that have struggled a little bit on Vista 64. Vista 64 runs those 32-bit native applications in a separate memory space. And so even if they do misbehave, they don't bring the whole operating system down. Generally, I've been pleased with the 64-bit version.
Some of the people when I've heard discussing this, there is occasionally some confusion about the difference between hardware and software when we're talking about 32 and 64. Clear that up for us, Brent.
Well, the processor and a lot of the modern motherboards in desktop machines and laptops are built to run 64-bit enabled software, and frankly, the hardware has been around for quite a while. Intel just released this week a new chip they're calling i7, and a new motherboard that goes along with that, and it's built for 64-bit operating system. So if you've been around long enough to remember what it was like to run on a 16-bit operating system and that
right.
move to 32-bit, we're kind of going through that again. We've come full circle. But clearly the hardware and the software is being built for 64-bit going forward. And a lot of the hardware that runs 32-bit software right now is capable of running 64-bit software.
So if somebody's running a desktop or a laptop right now that they bought with Vista on it, if they went and got a copy of Vista 64, that machine would run that just fine as a rule, right?
Well, the best advice is to verify the hardware components prior to installing the 64-bit operating system. But if the hardware is 3 years old or less, more than likely it's going to run the 64-bit version of the operating
sure.
system
sure.
without issue.
Okay. So, and Randy, you talked about, in that town hall that I was referring to at Sleater, you talked about one more piece of advice where you told, at least I think what you were telling some of those people who were objecting was to use that desktop virtualization and throw an XP VM on your machine and move forward from there, right?
Yeah, if in fact you're concerned or you discover an application that does not work, then your safety net is clearly an XP virtual machine, which is relatively easy to build, and frankly, you'll be able to use for years and years from now the way we see this all coming out. So The other part of that advice, though, that's pretty solid, I believe, is if you're going to buy a brand new machine, particularly if you have a VMware workstation available, there is a utility that packages up your desktop, and you can completely run your existing old desktop with all its applications in a virtual machine temporarily while smoothing out your new installation. So we're actually very frequently now doing this conversion routine where we point to an old desktop, package it up, which takes about 30 minutes, verify that the image runs as a virtual machine, and move that old image over temporarily to the new machine, and then install on the new machine and go from there. The caution you need to hear, though, is that we want to get the licensing right, and so many of our listeners buy OEM licenses from HP or Dell instead of open licenses. The Windows operating system, the Microsoft Office, if you bought it from the manufacturers and don't have it on open licenses, then in fact, you know, you would be in violation of the licenses following that piece of advice.
Right.
But if you're on open licenses, that's exactly what they're intended to do.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that you know, the native backup file format now in Windows Server 2008 and Vista is a VHD format. So if you use the built-in backup tool to create a backup of your machine, you're going to get a VHD file, you know, which is the supported format in the Microsoft virtualization platform.
Yeah, and you know, if you think about other backup tools like Acronis TrueImage, it actually does a pure backup and allows you to either back up a virtual machine and restore it as a real machine or reverse.
Interesting, interesting stuff. I've got one more topic that I want to spend some time on, and Randy, this basically comes out of your session on taking your practice online. I sat in there and listened to literally dozens of different ideas of products and services that people were using to accomplish remote access or their practice online, so to speak. So I thought it would be interesting to have each of us talk about a couple of those different products and then get some reactions. So kind of set up that for us a little bit, Randy. What kinds of things are we talking about?
Well, the key thing here is to figure out a way to support your clients and your own practice by having everything accessible through the web. And that might mean through a web browser, or it might mean through a thin client like Citrix or some other competitive client. But the concept is that you can work on any of your applications, regardless of where you are, with very little, if anything, installed on your local hard drive. So it's quite a different mindset if you can say, I could walk up to a kiosk in a hotel and get to everything that I need for my clients. So this has been available for some time, for example, in the Thomson Virtual Office, where they really had all of the Thomson applications and all of Microsoft Office hosted and so forth. But we're really trying to take it all the rest of the way that everything can be hosted. So the tools that we were looking at here were tools that enabled us to do different types of things, all completely online. And you don't have to have everything. You need to pick what makes the most sense for your business. So I basically said that I think paperless is the fundamental building block around this. But even at that, it's probably not required. And then from there, since this was a QuickBooks-centric crowd, we talked about things like e-commerce and CRM, customer relationship management, and other web-enabled tools and so forth. So that's the frame, is all the different applications that we have, how do we get those to run online?
Sure.
So I guess kind of taking off with that, you know, I'm going to pick on two paperless tools to get us started. One of those being Bill.com, which we've discussed on this program before, an accounts payable paperless processing tool, integrates into QuickBooks, but frankly is available for firms to sign up for and actually use in their firm at no charge, and then use with their clients at no charge to the firm. All around, I think, a pretty good approach. Another one that's becoming of age is the Smart Vault product, which I know you've done multiple comments and webcasts on that product as well. But again, a paperless product primarily focused on the QuickBooks Marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those products allow you through a browser to get to a SaaS tool that then integrates back to your desktop. Now, one other tool that I'm very pleased with that is doing two-way integration into QuickBooks is a tool called Method. And Method allows you to have a completely browser-enabled application that will update QuickBooks data really almost in real time as you're updating it on the website. And that really is of the mold of Salesforce or other products that really are completely SaaS, but then the plumbing is hooked up to get back to other products.
Right. So in Method, it's methodintegration.com, and those guys, they've actually let you build whatever little application or tools that that you might want to build, and they do the integration, consequently the name of their product, into a QuickBooks file, right?
That's correct. And, you know, that product is actually, I think, getting simple enough that a typical practitioner could use it, but certainly somebody from their technical team would be able to use it. Whereas other tools that are out there, Apatar by name, for example, is, I think, still a little too technical to use, but does a marvelous job of hooking Salesforce.com into Google Docs, into QuickBooks, and into Exchange, and into SQL, and all sorts of other connections.
So, and we'll include all of these obviously in the show notes, and I will remind all of our listeners over on another podcast in the Intersection Live family that I do every month with Doug Sleeters called Small Business Consulting to Go, and we actually recorded that live at the Sleeter Conference, and we recorded it with Rene Lassert, and we talked about Bill.com and that whole genre, the whole idea, and how that stuff works. So if you want more in depth on that, just pop over and grab Small Business Consulting to Go, and you'll get some more information on that one. So Randy, you had Bill.com, SmartVault.com, and MethodIntegration.com. Darren, what are your favorites in this one?
Well, we're currently using Bill.com and Smart Vault. We find application for both, and I like both of those products that Randy mentioned. We like to use QuickBooks in a hosting environment, and there's some companies out there doing that. But, you know, we were talking about all this kind of hosting stuff. You know, one of the ways that we actually reach all of our applications is connecting back to our office remotely as opposed to having things sitting out somewhere else.
Sure.
And are you guys doing much of that, Brent or Randy, where you're actually just connecting back to the office, or are you using software as a service more on most of your applications at this point?
Well,
you know,
Go ahead,
Brent.
I was just going to say we just implemented Terminal Server Gateway, which is a new technology in Windows Server 2008, and our users tell us, our auditors and others who spend a lot of time out of the office, that the pain associated with gaining access to resources internally has now gone away with that particular product, and it's a tremendous jump forward in terms of remote access securely to internal resources.
You know, one of the things, Brent, I've always done is just get a VPN connection and remote desktop back. Am I giving up some security if I go that direction versus the direction you guys are going?
Well, the idea of a VPN and then a remote desktop is kind of what Terminal Server Gateway eliminates. So Terminal Server Gateway enables you to get a remote desktop session without first establishing a VPN. And the advantage to that is, at least for our auditors, you know, sometimes they'll be in a client location where they don't want to open, you know, the ports on their firewall necessary to support a VPN, or they don't have them open. Terminal Server Gateway supports the secure transaction to the remote desktop over port 80, which virtually every external location allows open on their firewalls.
Does that make remote workplace, and maybe I'm not saying that right, but remote workplace more obsolete? Is that a replacement for that?
Well, remote web workplace is a technology that Microsoft built into Small Business Server. And the new version of Small Business Server and the Essential Business Server actually support this one-click access to your desktop from an external location using the Terminal Server Gateway technology.
So, Brent, just so that I want to make sure that I'm clear on the Terminal Services Gateway, that works just like if I'm hitting an Exchange server using RPC over HTTP, I'm just using it. There's nothing I have to do. I just launch Outlook and I'm connected. This Terminal Services Gateway does exactly the same thing. Is that right?
It does the same thing for remote desktop. So
right.
Think of it as RDP, remote desktop, over HTTP. It
okay.
tunnels the secure connection over port 80, which is open on virtually every firewall.
Right. So it does what it was doing before. It just makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, it eliminates the need for a VPN, and it eliminates the need to make sure that VPN-related ports are open on external firewalls.
Sure. Okay.
That's
so, Darren, you've kind of covered the ones that you like, or did you have another one to mention?
I mean, obviously, Citrix is another one that that we've used quite a bit.
That would be go to my PC.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So, Brent, you like the Terminal Services Gateway. What else do you have that you see people using, or that you use, or that you like?
Well, there's a couple other new technologies in Server 08 that I just want to mention here. One is Terminal Server Remote Apps. And so this gives administrators the ability to publish a single application on a website. And the application actually runs on a back-end terminal server, but to the user that's external, you know, to them, they're just running that application. It's bridging the gap to what's called the Softricity, the application virtualization that
right.
That we're going to see more of going forward. And then the Terminal Server Web application, which Darren mentioned, is packaged in Remote Web Workplace in the Small Business Server and Essential Business Server products, is also available as part of Windows Server 2008 as well. And that is accessed from a web page to a particular terminal server or another machine on the internal network.
Interesting. Interesting stuff. So,
yeah, and we've implemented the same stuff, you know, almost just the same style that Brent has done, and we do see those as replacement technologies in the next generation of terminal services replacements. So a lot of the difficult plumbing is going to get to go away for something that's much simpler for the common end user to use.
Yeah, when you think about some of the things, Randy, that I heard people talking about in your class, for example, was just the ability to hit their office machine from home, a one-to-one relationship using things like go to my PC or log me in, or I mean, I happen to use Live Mesh, and so one of the features of Live Mesh, it will allow me to access any machine that's part of my mesh, which would be my office machine, my home desktop, and my laptop, I can access any one of the three from any other one of the three, you know, quite easily. And that's you know, that makes go to my PC, or I heard many people talk about log me in, same same thing, just a different brand name on it, right?
Yep.
Okay. So, you know, I like the live mesh thing because it's that works obviously if you're in a spot where you're just using your home machine to access your office machine or something like that. We talked a little bit about hosting, and there's a lot of talk about what's happening in the QuickBooks hosting world. I keep hearing, and I've heard it for a long time, not heard it officially yet, but I keep hearing that Intuit is finally going to solve the licensing quagmire. You talked about licensing before, Randy, and as you know, the QuickBooks license disallows QuickBooks from being run in a commercial hosted environment, but they don't enforce that. And so there are hundreds, probably even thousands of people hosting QuickBooks files for other people, including a lot of accounting firms, all over the country. But there's some real mystery as to whether or not at the end of the day Intuit will actually allow that, or what's going to happen. And the information is that at some point, Intuit is going to step up and say, okay, here are a dozen or two or one or three or whatever the number is, people that we have officially anointed that we will allow to host our QuickBooks product, and no one else can do that. You guys hearing anything like that? Or, I mean, I don't want to spread a whole lot of rumors, but I want to understand what might be happening so people can think about this.
Well, we don't know the exact number of hosting companies, although it's clear that both InSync and Wright Networks have such licenses.
Right, correct.
And we think there may be another half dozen or so of those licenses, but cannot confirm that directly from Intuit. It's clear that the other two big hosters of QuickBooks, as I see it, are real-time bookkeeping and real-time data services, just to name two more of those ones that could be in the gray zone. But bottom line is that we think that Intuit is going to do a bit more of the enforcement of that, so we want people to be cautious. And it's always been a surprise to me that Intuit actually didn't jump into the hosting business themselves.
Yep, I absolutely agree. Darren, do you know anything about that? Did you hear anything? There's a lot of talk about that at the Sleater Group conference.
Yeah, I've heard several people talking about the exact same thing, and essentially the way you spoke about it. So I don't know. The only thing I've heard recently, or actually at Doug at the Sleater conference, was this is supposed to be coming down fairly soon. And again, I don't know if that's rumor, but it sounds like maybe by the end of the year we should know something.
Right. Well, we will. We'll obviously keep our ear to the floor on that, and hear whenever we know what's going on. Certainly report. Obviously, there's no action that needs to be taken by anyone at this point. Just something to be aware of. I did have one more note that I put down here when we were talking about these remote access things. Just something that's it's certainly not remote access. It's just something that I think is way, way cool. Been experimenting with all of the new browsers, IE8 and the latest Firefox version and Chrome. And one of the things that Chrome does is allows you to convert any web page to basically to an application. So you just right click on, you've got a web page open and you're all sitting there ready to go, and you right click on that, and it's different than sending just a link to the desktop. It's kind of an interesting approach. You got the little icon there, and for example, I got one for TalkShoe there, and I click on it, and when I launch it, I'm all logged in and ready to go. It's kind of an interesting idea, and I don't know that the other browsers do it quite at that level.
We don't know of any other one that does, and I've played with that same feature, Greg, and it's pretty interesting because there is some indicators that some of these SaaS applications are locking up much more frequently than they should in IE, and I actually spent, I'll call it dysfunctionally, 3 or 4 hours on Saturday afternoon and evening playing with Firefox 3.1 beta, the Chrome product, and the IE 8 beta. Uh-huh. I was just trying to understand the differences, and
right.
So, you know, it was one of those things that I probably should have been sitting in the other room watching TV, but I was watching browsers.
I understand.
And as it turns out, the speed of Chrome and lots of other very interesting features and, in fact, functionality that was exposed off the Google sites in Chrome was not visible in Firefox 3.1 or IE 8 or 7, because I went back to check it, and it's like, well, this is very interesting. So Google actually has Chrome-only content as well.
Huh.
So I think what's going to happen is we're going to wind up with some very interesting new features that Chrome will enable, because its function and mission in life is to be a multi-application. Each tab is intended to be a separate running application, and it's really intended to support this SaaSable hosted environment.
Yes.
And as I've been thinking about this hosting issue, because Microsoft obviously has their now $10 Exchange SharePoint hosting available, which is a good deal and a good thing, Google's approach for hosting is really $50 a year. And when you divide that by 12, you realize there's some very, very large-scale deployments of things like Google Docs that are occurring.
Right.
And I've actually read 5 articles in the last 4 days on that. Washington, D.C. government, 38,000 seats, and other examples of that. The Bechtel example of building out all of their infrastructure in a Google-like way, SaaSable and so forth. These browsers become an important part of that long-term strategy. So we need to keep our eye on that ball over the next 4 to 6 months as it evolves.
We need to say just a word about security here, too, because, this is Google's first attempt at a browser. And
right.
Although it's really good, like any other V1 product, there have been a number of security issues identified with that particular browser.
Yeah. I will tell you that in terms of just plain raw speed, that my little informal undocumented tests show that this thing is 3 and 4 times faster than IE8.
Yeah, as a matter of fact,
it is blazingly fast.
I did some tests like that, and my numbers are even bigger than that, Greg. So it is radically faster than IE7 or 8.
Yeah, it's so fast when you launch a website and it pops up that fast, you just kind of whoa, where did that come from? Like, how did they have that in cache already?
Yeah, in fact, it was interesting because I specifically went through and timed pages in 3.1 and in IE8 and IE7 and so forth, and I always led with Chrome, which in theory would populate the DNS first. So the other browser refreshes got the advantage of already having the DNS table look up local.
Sure.
And even at that, they were slower.
Right. Well, we'll keep looking at those and let you know. But it's going to be interesting. I think it's great that that there's some good strong competition out there. So that's interesting, guys. We have burned our hour, and I want to make sure that we get out of here on time. I know, Randy, you've got some whales out there that you want to go chase, and I don't want to get in between you on that. So just a quick note to everybody: we will record our Tech2Go episode 24, December edition, on Tuesday, December 16th. At 4:30 Eastern Standard Time. So that's Tuesday, December 16th, 4:30 Eastern. If you'd like to join us at TalkShoe.com, feel free. We had people in with us today, and we always look forward to that. If you have comments or thoughts, we do maintain a voicemail box, 800-456-0864, extension 2106. You've got ideas or suggestions or complaints or gentle nudges, we'd certainly look forward to that. I did have the opportunity with all three of you in the last couple of weeks at these conferences to have multiple people come up and say, we listen to the podcasts and we enjoy them and thanks, and we find them valuable, and that's always really, really great to hear. And so we'd encourage you to stay with us and tell your friends, and it's fun. I know the guys all enjoy doing it. I certainly enjoy doing it. I thank you all for your time. Have a great Thanksgiving, and Randy, enjoy your vacation. Brent,
aloha,
Aaron,
from the garden now.
Thanks so very much for your time. This has been Tech2Go episode 23. Greg LaFollette for Intersection Live, the podcast series of the CPA Technology Advisor. Thank you. This has been Tech2Go episode 23, User Conference Review 2008.
For more information about the CPA Technology Advisor's other podcast programs, webcasts, and our e-newsletter, visit www.cpatechadvisor.com. To ask questions or leave comments about our podcasts, call 800-456-0864, extension 2106, or tune into future episodes where you're able to ask questions live via TalkShoe.com.